fear of Trump. You can't let fear rule you. You have to stand up to your fear of, if you're somehow in a very twisted mindset where you don't like Clinton so much that you're going to vote for Trump, you have to get over your fear of Clinton. And you have to understand there are two individuals, not that that matters as much as the institutions behind them, the political parties and the capitalist system, but there are two individuals and institutions that you should be equally afraid of if you're a working person. But what does that mean, fear? Why is this a afraid thing? What are you for? What are you positive about? Jill Stein has made some good statements about this. You know, go back to Eugene Debs talking about, I'd rather vote for something I want and not get it than vote for something I don't want and get it. You know, I mean, this is, you know, where's your self-esteem? Where's your guts? Where's your courage? You're just going to vote because you're scared of something? That's all you're going to vote for? You're not going to vote for a future for your kids? Because none of the Republican Democrats, the Republidems, or whatever you want to call them, there's no future for our children. They're going to run this planet. I'm sorry, the ecology fit for human habitation. There'll still be a rock floating through space. But, you know, in terms of human life, they're going to run that down under the short-term expectation of profit to the point where people are going to be dying, as they already are, actually, from climate change and from destruction of the human ecology, basically, through the relentless short-term maximization of profit, which is the god of capitalism, which is the modus operandi of capitalism, which is then, therefore, the god of the political parties, the corporate political parties that represent capitalists in this country, the parties they control, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. So continuing on with Melissa Crosby here in this essay, I'll repeat this line because it's a part of the paragraph I want to read. You are all quite reasonably afraid of the nightmare that might come with a Trump presidency. We fear that too. But the thing I'd like you to understand is that we are already living in crisis mode. We understand that while the candidates differ in significant ways, both Clinton and Trump offer unthinkable options, whether cutting services, limiting our rights, and inciting hatred or promoting increasingly pro-corporate agenda, destroying our planet, or sending our children to endless war. And I'll just finish up with a few other things she says. Please hear this. I'm furious right now. I'm furious that my hard work to leave my kids a brighter future is being mocked and belittled everywhere I turn. I'm furious that Obama protected Clinton from the FBI and then came out in full support of the woman who he himself declared would, quote, say anything and do nothing, end quote. I'm furious that the mainstream media told lies about us and about, when she's referring to we or us, she's talking about Sanders supporters. She's, you know, obviously a Bernie or bust Sandernista type. You know, from my perspective, that's not left-wing enough, but it's, you know, a lot of people were attracted to Sanders based on some of the issues that he put forward that were progressive, and they expected more of the Democratic Party than it could ever give, obviously, and that's what she's talking about. But the reason I'm reading some of this is not because I, you know, feel like she is very astute about the Democratic Party, although she's learning, obviously. It's because that she very well articulates why there's no alternative out there for her if it's just going to be Clinton and Trump. You know, then she says, I'm furious Elizabeth Warren, who built a career on getting big money on politics, and then when it was safe, went all in for the Wall Street candidate. Now, actually, I hope that Melissa Crosby, whoever she is, reads more or finds out more about Elizabeth Warren, who was a Republican at one point. She has not always been about getting big money out of politics. And I think that given her class background and given the role she's played at Harvard as a law professor, it's not much of a jump to say, oh, yeah, she's comfortable with Wall Street fundamentally, despite her left populist rhetoric. I'm furious that the mainstream media flat out lied in order to suppress the vote. I'm furious that the lies of the Clinton campaign told about Sanders and the chaos and distrust they caused when infiltrating our networks. I'm furious that the media, and this was back in June before WikiLeaks, by the way, she's writing this. I'm furious that the media created the Trump monster. I'm furious that hundreds of thousands of folks in Arizona and New York were denied the right to vote. Now she's talking about like stuff that happened within the Democratic Party primary. And then she finishes with, There have been a lot of disappointments lately, but very possibly the worst of all is realizing that good people don't seem to give a damn about corruption and fraud as long as their candidate wins. So, you know, that's interesting. That's good stuff. But now we're going to get a little more hardcore and go after your hero if you're a lesser evilist, and shame on you for having this hero, or you're holding your nose, shame on you for just holding your nose, and it's Hillary Clinton. And we're going to get into some facts and figures about Hillary. First of all, though, I have to give the station's identification here. We are 91.5 FM, WMFO Medford, our legal ID, WMFO Medford, or WMFO in Medford. Also known as Tufts Freeform Commercial Free Radio. Freeform Commercial Free Community-Based Radio. That's the phrase I like. I think I made that one up. But it's been referred to under those terms as well in various ways. And also Tufts Educational Radio. Okay. Enough self-identification. And by the way, anything you hear on the show that you like, as we've said in other shows, we're not just here to promote alternative information from a sort of general left progressive perspective. We're here to organize. We are here to get you involved in socialism. Join Socialist Alternative. We're here to say, get involved in the struggle to build socialism, to build democratic socialism in this country and around the world. Check us out at socialistalternative.org for more information. Go to socialistworld.net. Check out the Committee for Workers International, which is an international socialist organization that Socialist Alternative in the United States is in political solidarity with. And just write to us. Go to the Socialist Alternative Radio Facebook page. Write in. And you know, most people would say, tell us what you think. And yeah, we want to know that. We want your opinion. But we're also not into just like, you know, debating for the sake of debate, you know. We are partisans. You know, if you're on our side, in a general sense, of the side of working people, and you want to get deeper into that struggle, and you want to really help make sure there's a future for this planet, and or at least for the people on the planet, then get in touch with us. You want to make sure that there's a more political choice in the future, get in touch with us. You want to make sure that unions start to grow again and get stronger, get in touch with us. Get in touch with Socialist Alternative at socialistalternative.org. Now, getting back into the lesser evil realm and why it's so absurd, this is an article called Hillary Clinton's Empowerment by Kevin Young and Diane C. Sierra Becerra. And it comes from, I don't have a citation from where it comes from, the way it printed out. I didn't get that. That happens sometimes. I don't know why these... Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. It's from Against the Current. Now, Against the Current is a left-wing magazine. I believe it's a monthly. I think it still comes out in print and online. It comes from the organization Solidarity, which is a socialist organization. And, we've had on the show, Steve Early's been on the show before. He used to, I think, do stuff with Solidarity, write for their publications from time to time. But if I'm mistaken about that, my apologies, Steve Early. Back to Kevin Young and Diane C. Sierra Becerra, Hillary Clinton's Empowerment. This is from Against the Current. And they say, quote, I'm going to just give a few quick excerpts. And they're talking mainly about, is Clinton really a feminist? And here's an interesting quote. They understand to a certain extent why she gets the label. She will be nominally the first woman, from, as they say, from a major political party nominated to be president. Now, this is tricky because you remember Ferrara, the Democratic Party woman who was going to be vice president. She was vice presidential nominee. There's tons of other women around, not enough, but tons around the world that have now served as the president or prime minister of their countries. The whole thing about Hillary first woman thing, very, very problematic because it was going to happen, and not later, but sooner. And it has happened in a lot of places. But most importantly, of course, you can't just go with the outward form. You have to go with the policies. And you can't just go with the individual. You have to go with the institution. And, of course, this is not how we're taught to think in America. We're taught to think mostly personalizing things. We're taught to think mostly in an somehow, even though it goes against every fabric of reality, we're supposed to think we're autonomous individuals when we're very much social creatures. We're supposed to think of individuals and not institutions, even though the institutions rule our lives, like, you know, capitalism as an institution and corporations as institutions and so on. And yet, you know, we're supposed to pretend, you know, we're supposed to say things like, I like her, she's really a good person, or I like him, he makes me feel X, Y, or Z. And that's supposed to pass as political discussion in the United States. And they will put those people on the air, the corporate media, over and over again. So you'll have a news show, whether it's local or national. What do you think of Hillary Clinton? I think she's very good. And down to our next, you know, and they'll go through that. And, you know, I'm not saying people are simplistic in their thinking, because the corporate media will ignore the person that has a well-worked-out thing. They'll ignore the worker that said, oh, I've sat down and figured it out, and Clinton is my mortal enemy, and I would never vote for it in 1,000 years. They won't interview that person. They won't let that person on. And if they did, they would just clip out some 20-second soundbite that would make them sound like an idiot. So, you know, here we're taught through, you know, very carefully edited and crafted examples to substitute personal likes and dislikes about personalities, and even like stylistic things. Like, I mean, you know, let's talk about Howard Dean again. Howard Dean got was hounded out of the Democratic Party primaries because he made a strange little yippee sound or something. I actually heard it the other night again, and it was kind of funny. But to loop that and play it 5 million times as a way to get someone out of the Democratic Party primary race was a stroke of genius. Usually the corporate media is not able to coordinate, I mean, to that extent. I mean, it's usually just a general full frontal assault, you know, and hope that some of the shells of stupidity land and blow up and people get injured by them and come back and say, I kind of like Donald Trump. He means what he says. You know, how many times have you heard that one? Now, I don't think every Donald Trump supporter is that much of a moron. Although they're really, 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 really mistaken in what they're doing, obviously. I say obviously. But, you know, I mean, it's like it's almost dehumanizing the way the corporate media puts on anyone from any supporting any corporate politician, because they want to channel the idea, with consciously or unconsciously, that political discourse means talking about superficial stuff that doesn't really matter. And the DNC, of course, was part of that. Democratic National Convention was just one big propaganda show. Shades of Nuremberg, if you want to take that from a certain angle. Not saying they're fascist. Just, you know, the flag thing. The flags and the chants of USA, USA, USA. Yeah, I mean, come on. But also the complete, you know, and they talk about this ad nauseum in the corporate media in their so-called analysis afterwards. Complete personalization, individualization of it around Hillary Rodham Clinton. And that is supposed to be how we're conceptualizing the Democratic Party. No, that doesn't matter. They could have a sock puppet up there, and you'd have to then go back and still say, well, what is the sock puppet or the people under, you know, manipulating the sock puppet? What have they done in government? What do they espouse in their speeches? What do they have in their platform? Now, platforms are completely useless because there's no accountability to the platform. But I even want to look at that, too. You know, just look at the material reality of the Democratic Party. Where does its money come from? You know, I'm sitting there. I'll give you an example. Read the, you know, I hate to say it, but, you know, actually read the New York Times a little bit over the last couple of weeks, their coverage of the Democratic National Convention, because it was mostly exactly what I'm describing. It was, you know, learned sounding chatter and gossip about personalities, and it meant almost nothing. But then next to the big articles that yammer on about Mr. Sanders's psychology about when he's going, how much he's going to stick his head up the butt of the Democratic Party establishment, you know, leave that aside for a minute. And it turns out it was extremely far, but leaving that aside for a minute, there's these articles, like little ones, like next to them. And I'm not sure why they're there. I think the, you know, it's, they want to track this sort of thing. Talking about the fundraising going on in the Democratic National Convention. I saw two of these articles, probably the only two that existed, but two articles about the Democratic National Convention fundraising going on, right, next to the psychological drama, according to the New York Times, going on in a big building nearby, the convention center. And that, and they managed to get like one or two quotes from, you know, really damning quotes from some politicians saying, yeah, we're here to, because these people are the bank, and we're here to get money from them. And it's all the rich people and all the rich corporate people in there, so happy that it seemed to be going the way they wanted, warts and all, that Clinton was going to get the nomination, and that was going pretty smoothly. and they a certain message was getting out, and here's your check, you know, and it's bigger than the last one. And there was a lot of, you know, just plain old, who funds the Democratic Party? The big corporations. Oh, so that means when they go out and make policy, they're not, as Hillary Clinton says, they're not going to pay attention to where the money comes from. Hillary Clinton doesn't have Goldman Sachs tattooed on her butt. Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? Of course, it's there in blazing red. And that's what, you know, she's going to be sitting on throughout the campaign. Figuratively speaking, the money of Goldman Sachs and other corporations is exactly what her campaign is going to be sitting on. Literally speaking, sorry. Anyway, so here's a more somber analysis of Clinton as feminist. Quote, and again, I'm quoting from this article from Against the Current, Kevin Young and Diana Cibiera Becerra. Quote, we suggest that feminist enthusiasm for Hillary Clinton is reflective of a profound crisis of U.S. liberal feminism, which has long embraced or accepted capitalism, racism, empire, and even heterosexism and transphobia. And basically, all issues of wealth, power, and violence are also women's and LGBT rights issues. For instance, neoliberal economic policies of austerity and privatization disproportionately hurt women and LGBT individuals, who are often the lowest paid and the first workers to be fired, the most likely to bear the burdens of family maintenance, and the most affected by the involuntary migration, domestic violence, homelessness, and mental illness that are intensified by poverty. So, you know, I think this is a really good article, and I'm going to read some more here. Bear with me while I read these excerpts. Clinton's record on such issues is hardly encouraging, and we're talking Hillary here. Her decades of service on corporate boards and in major policy roles as First Lady, Senator, and Secretary of State give a clear indication of where she stands. One of Clinton's first high-profile positions was at Walmart, where she served on the board of Walmart from 1986 to 1992. That's Walmart I'm talking about there, 1986 to 1992. She, quote unquote, remained silent in board meetings as her company, quote, waged a major campaign against labor unions seeking to represent store workers, end quote. And this is as an ABC review of video recordings later noted. Clinton recounts in her 2003 book, Living History, that Walmart CEO Sam Walton, quote, taught me. Can I do a Hillary Clinton imitation? Let's see. All right. Okay. Taught me a great deal about corporate integrity and success, end quote. So she knows a great deal about corporate integrity and success. Now, is corporate integrity, are those two words oxymorons? Are those two words opposites? Of course, absolutely. There's no such thing as corporate integrity. There's no such thing as corporate integrity. That really bothers me that she would use the words corporate and integrity to mean corporate integrity. But anyway, let's see, where are we? I actually stood up and gesticulated while I was speaking. No, I'm not kidding. I didn't stand up, but I still have lost my space here. All right, so here we go. Later, she tried to shed her public identification with Walmart in order to attract labor support for her Senate and presidential candidacies. Walmart executives, however, have continued to look favorably on her, with Alice Walton donating the maximum amount to the, quote, Ready for Hillary, end quote, super PAC in 2013. So Hillary got a big push way back in 2013 from Walmart, from Alice Walton, who's a co-owner of Walmart. Walton's $25,000 donation was considerably higher than the average annual salary for Walmart's hourly employees, two-thirds of whom are women. Now listen to that fact again. Walton's $25,000 donation was considerably higher than the average annual salary for Walmart's hourly employees, two-thirds of whom are women. They're not even paying people $25,000 a year. Can you believe that? Higher than the average, $25,000 higher than the average annual salary for Walmart workers, two-thirds of whom are women. And she wants to be a feminist? You want to be a feminist if you vote for her? You're not going to be a feminist anymore if you vote for Hillary Clinton. I'm sorry. No, you're not. You can't say that. You just can't. Because you just screwed over tens of thousands, millions maybe, of women who are voting Walmart, one of the largest employers in the country. And they don't get paid anything. And Clinton made that happen, helped make that happen. After leaving Walmart, Clinton became perhaps the most active first lady in history. While it'd be unfair to hold her responsible for all of her husband's policies, that would be Bill Clinton 1.0, she did play a significant role in shaping and justifying many of them. And this, by the way, is well documented. I don't have time to go into some other documentation I have about it, but I'll continue with this. In, quote, Living History, some sort of book. Oh, that's her. Wait a minute. Living History is Hillary's 2003 book. Clinton herself, Hillary herself, boasts of her role of gutting U.S. welfare. Quote, by the time Bill and I left the White House, welfare rolls had dropped 60%, unquote. Yay! Good job, Hillary. And anyone that's going to vote for Hillary, good job helping her screw over poor people. And not because poverty had dropped, by the way, is the end of that sentence. Women and children, the main recipients of welfare, have been the primary victims of Clinton's policies. Jeffrey St. Clair at Counterpunch notes that prior to welfare reform, quote, more than 70% of poor families with children received some kind of cash assistance. By 2010, less than 30% got any kind of cash aid, and the amount of the benefits had declined by more than 50% from pre-reform levels. And one reason for that, there's many reasons built into the legislation that the Clintons pushed to end welfare as we know it, quote unquote, back in the 90s, was that basically a big part of that is dumping everything on the states, a la states' rights that the Southerners like so much from Jim Crow and all that, dumping welfare payments out of the states, and the states just, especially the Southern states where Clinton, where the Clintons always like to get that support from, they just, you know, killed the welfare, the social welfare payments and so on. They just really, really wrecked them. There's some going on, but it's just really, really diminished from what it was. Clinton also lobbied Congress to pass her husband's deeply racist crime bill, which Michelle Alexander observes in the new Jim Crow, quote, escalated the drug war beyond what conservatives had imagined possible, expanding mass incarceration and the death penalty. Yes, please don't forget, Clinton 1.0, with the help of Clinton 2.0, with the help of Hillary, they did a huge increase of expanding the federal death penalty. Again, yay, right? Isn't that great? Murdering people, the state murdering people and giving the state that power to murder people, isn't that wonderful? Including many people that are completely innocent, as the Innocence Project and many others are discovering now with more technology and so on. Anyway, arguably the two most definitive features of Clinton's tenures as senator 2001-2009 and secretary of state 2009-2013 were her promotion of U.S. corporate profit-making and her aggressive assertion of the U.S. government's right to intervene in foreign countries. Reflecting on this performance as Clinton left her secretary post in January 2013, Bloomberg Businessweek commented that, quote, Clinton turned the State Department into a machine for promoting U.S. big business, unquote. She sought to, quote, install herself as the government's highest-ranking business lobbyist, directly negotiating lucrative overseas contracts for U.S. corporations like Boeing, Lockheed, and General Electric. Not surprisingly, Clinton's corporate cheerleading has won praise from business groups, end quote. Clinton's corporate cheerleading has won praise from business groups. This is not that long ago. This article that's being quoted within this article is from January 2013, Bloomberg Businessweek. Clinton herself has been very honest about this aim, albeit not when speaking in front of progressives. Her 2011 foreign policy essay, Foreign Policy is the name of a journal, essay on America's Pacific Century, end quote, that's the title, America's Pacific Century, speaks at length about the objective of, quote, opening new markets for American businesses, end quote, containing no fewer than 10 uses of the phrases open markets, open trade, and permutations thereof. So she's going to be against the TPP? Well, that they get into this right now. They say a major focus of this effort is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which involves 12 Pacific countries, is being secretly negotiated by the Obama administration with the assistance of over 600 corporate advisors. Now, Clinton has come out against TPP recently. I think that's going to get reversed, or she's going to allow it to get reversed without her specific reversal of it. You know, she's going to stand aside, and the rest of the Democrats are going to do the dirty work like Obama is doing right now. But I think most likely she's just going to come to embrace it maybe a year or two into her office if she gets elected, which, again, I think is most likely, but, you know, we'll see. Not the only scenario by any means. So anyway, it goes. This is a very good article again from Against the Current. Again, titled "Hillary Clinton's Empowerment." I don't have time to read all the stuff here, but they go into her foreign policy stuff, military use abroad. Forceful advocate. One of the administration's most forceful advocates of attacking or expanding military operations in Afghanistan, Libya, that's attacking or expanding military operations in Afghanistan, Libya, and Syria, and strengthening U.S. ties to dictatorships in Tunisia, Egypt, Yemen, Bahrain, Morocco, and elsewhere. Maybe the women and girls of these countries, including those whose lives have been destroyed by U.S. bombs, can take comfort in knowing that a, quote, feminist, quote, unquote, helped craft U.S. policy. Clinton ensured that Palestine's UN statehood bid went nowhere in the Security Council. Though out of office by the time Israel launched its savage 2014 assault on Gaza, she ardently defended it in interviews. This context helps explain her recent praise for Henry Kissinger, renowned for bombing civilians and supporting governments that killed and tortured hundreds of thousands of suspected dissidents. She writes in the Washington Post that she, quote, relied on Kissinger's counsel when I served as Secretary of State. And then they go to Central America, what Clinton and Clinton 1.0 and Clinton 1.2 have done, what Clinton herself did as Secretary of State, etc. This is interesting. A reasonable synopsis of Clinton's record around the world comes from neoconservative policy advisor Robert Kagan, who, like Clinton, played an important role in advocating the 2003 invasion of Iraq, which, of course, Clinton supported. Quote, I feel comfortable with her on foreign policy. That's from Kagan. He told the New York Times last June. Asked what to expect from a Hillary Clinton presidency, Kagan predicted, quote, if she pursues a policy which we think she will pursue, it's something that might be called neocon, end quote. But he added, quote, clearly her supporters are not going to call it that. They're going to call it something else. And you heard all the something else's at the Democratic Party National Convention. Actually, you didn't hear much about foreign policy at all, but you heard all the wonderful things about Clinton, which were lies, basically. And, you know, it's funny because Trump said, oh, there were a lot of lies in the Democratic National Convention. Well, he should know a lie when he sees one, number one. But number two, just because he says it doesn't make it automatically completely wrong, although the things he thought were lies were probably true, and things that really were lies were lies. Let's see. Reproductive rights. Clinton has a very narrow definition of such, saying many times, quote, safe, legal, and rare abortions, which reinforces the stigmatization of those who choose an abortion option, and not much material support for parents or young children, and they have, through the 1996 welfare reform and fiscal austerity, she has participated in actually cuts to women and children. And they've also defined, according to this article, both Clintons have defined reproductive rights very narrowly as abortion and contraception only. And therefore, they have total disconnect when they're cutting programs that would help women and children, that would help reproductive rights and through welfare reform and fiscal austerity and so on. Whole thing about LGBT. Little serious indication she opposes discrimination against LGBT in the workplace, which is still legal in the majority of U.S. states. In other words, they're not saying she's going to lead the way on that at all. Her very recent reversal of her position on gay marriage came only after support for the idea had become politically very popular and beneficial and perhaps necessary for the Democratic Party to embrace that issue. So anyway, I really don't have time. It's a really good article. I really attempted to read a lot more of it, but running out of time. She said, quote, in a review of her, in a review of her work as Secretary of State, Middle East scholar Stephen Zunes concludes that while, quote, Hillary Clinton has been more outspoken than any previous Secretary of State regarding the rights of women and sexual minorities, this position is more rhetoric than reality. And as one example, he points out to the U.S.-backed monarchy in Morocco, which has long occupied Western Sahara with U.S. support. 2 weeks after Secretary Clinton publicly praised the dictatorship for having, quote, protected and expanded women's rights, a teenage girl named Amina Falali committed suicide by taking rat poison. Falali had been raped at age 15 and been forced to marry her rapist in Morocco, who subsequently battered and abused her. In other words, using that one example, Morocco, but there are many others throughout the Middle East, dictatorial regimes with horrifically anti-women policies were embraced by the Obama administration through Clinton as Secretary of State, and yet she calls herself a feminist, and people believe it, and it's just not true if you really think about what that means and what it should mean. And then I'm going to move on very quickly to talking about some things that were written, quotes from Mumia Abu-Jamal, about the election choices. It's from an article from counterpunch.org. The time is now, how to defeat both Trump and Clinton's neoliberalism. Before I do that, actually, I'm going to jump into a book here called Listen Liberal by Thomas Frank. A couple quotes, more quotes about Clinton, Hillary Clinton, where she comes from. But before we get to that, we're going to take a quick musical interlude. And you're listening to WMFO 91.5 FM, Tufts Free Foreign Commercial Free Radio. And we're listening in this subset of the community base here of the radio station is Socialist Alternative Radio, talk and music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. I'm your host today, Jeff, and thanks for listening, and we'll be right back.
Desert, there's a soldier lying dead, vultures pecking the eyes out of his head. Another day that could have been me there instead. Nobody loves me here, nobody. you'll be trapping your own pieces. With every bullet your risk increases. Old Alibaba is a different species. Nobody loves me here, nobody loves me here. Dad's gonna kill me. Dad's gonna kill me. Another on the way. I might get home if I can live through today. Before I came out here, I never used to pray. Nobody loves me here. Nobody loves me here. Dad's gonna kill me. Well, Dad's in a bad mood. Dad's got the blues. It's someone else's mess that I didn't choose. At least we're winning on the Fox Evening News. Nobody loves me here. Nobody loves me. Dad's gonna kill me. Dad's gonna kill me. That stranger walking in my dreams. Who's that stranger casting shadow across my heart? Who's that stranger? I dare speak his name. Must be your death a walking. Must be your death a walking. Dad's gonna kill me. Seven muzzle monkeys standing in a row, standing waiting for that sandbox to blow. Sitting targets in the Wild West show. Nobody loves me here. Nobody loves me. Dad's gonna kill me. Dad's gonna kill me.
Richard Thompson from Sweet Warrior, Dad's Gonna Kill Me. And then before that, Green Day, Holiday. And we got a little more music coming up after some more talk, because this is talk and music from a working class democratic socialist perspective, otherwise known as Socialist Alternative Radio, here every other Sunday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. on WMFO 91.5 FM, WMFO.org, WMFO.org. And numbers to think about, public service announcement here, some numbers to think about. The United States has less than 5% of the planet's population, but incarcerates 24% of its prisoners in prisons and accounts for 43% of the world's total military spending. A public service message from WMFO in Medford, Tufts Educational Radio. And by the way, keeping in theme, if you think that electing a Democrat over a Republican or a Republican over a Democrat is going to change those numbers, you're nuts. It's just going to make them worse either way. I want to read one more public service announcement. I'm looking for like a short one because, well, we don't have much time left. And, oh, here we go. Don't drink and drive PSA. This is short and sweet. And you should see the graphic, the mangled up automobiles. Yuck. If you're under the influence of anything, never even think about getting behind the wheel of a car and driving. People die that way. A public service message from WMFO in Medford, Tufts Educational Radio. I've had a few instances of, you know, speaking so quickly, I've said some really embarrassing things on the radio here, but we'll ignore those for now. Thomas Frank, listen, liberal. It should be entitled Thomas Frank, listen up yourself, because I'm reading this book and rereading it, going to do a book review on it, and it's basically like he's going after the Democratic Party and then basically saying Democratic Party's okay. Going after Hillary and then, you know, whatever. I don't know if he says Hillary's okay. I have to think about that for a second, but I would bet anything he's going to vote. He's putting forward a vote for her. Frank is the author of stuff like What's the Matter with Kansas, former columnist for the Wall Street Journal, so you can see his parameters, but he's not going to go he's not going to go any further than liberalism to the left. Not that liberalism is even on the left, really, but there are some interesting... I heard him on the radio. The book is very recent. It came out this year, and I thought that might have some good stats or something on the Democrats and so on, and it does. So in that case, I going to the library was worth the trip. I don't buy stuff like this. Are you kidding? Anyway, here's a chapter 11 from Frank's book. Read a couple excerpts from it real quick. Liberal guilt, that's spelled G-I-L-T. Quote, we have now observed several instances of the cycle of enthusiastic idealism that propels modern democratic politics, as well as the lagging cycle of disappointment that invariably follows it. Both cycles are highly predictable given the economic desperation of ordinary Americans, and so is the next stage in this process, the transfer of this passionate idealism to Hillary Clinton. Now, he wrote this long before the DNC. In fact, this book was published, as I said, recently, but not that recently. So how can he predict that Clinton would be the nominee, which he's kind of implying there, which he is implying there? This was copyright 2016, so it came out this year. I think it came out around March, maybe? I don't know. That's just a guess on my part. And anyway, he wrote it. He took stuff from earlier columns he's written and blah blah blah, but here he is basically saying that in terms of this analysis of who's going to be Democratic Party presidential nominee, he's basically saying it's Clinton long before this should have been evident. So everybody knows it was a rigged thing, but I just thought I'd mention it again. So he says, after losing to Barack, after losing to Barack Obama in the Democratic primaries in 2008, she waited patiently for years to pass, serving as Secretary of State, etc. Now, moving along quickly, he also puts forward, and again, this is a guy that is probably going to vote for Clinton, probably likes her in a lot of ways. He's saying basically, financiers and hedge fund managers do not actually find Hillary's populism menacing. And this is a well-established fact. Only a few days before she launched her campaign, for example, John Mack, the former CEO of Morgan Stanley, was asked by a host on the Fox Business Channel whether Hillary Clinton's populist talk was causing him, meaning the former CEO of Morgan Stanley, John Mack, to reconsider his support for Clinton. On the contrary, quote, to me, it's all politics, he responded. It's trying to get elected, to get the nomination. None of them think she really means her populism wrote a prominent business journalist in 2014 about the bankers and Hillary Clinton. The Clinton Foundation has actually held meetings at the headquarters of Goldman Sachs, he points out. He quotes another Morgan Stanley officer who believes that, quote, like her husband, Hillary will govern from the center and work to get things done and be capable of garnering support across different groups, including working with Republicans. And then we have Robert Rubin, former chairman of Citibank, former secretary of the Treasury, former co-head of Goldman Sachs. One of the themes in his book is Rubin's constant war with the populists in the Democratic Party. Notice he's involved in that war. Notice he's part of the Democratic Party. And in the Clinton administration, a struggle in which Hillary was an important ally. Rubin tells how Hillary once helped him to get what he calls, quote, class-laden language, unquote, deleted from a presidential speech, and how she helped to prevent the Democrats from appealing to class conflict in a general election on the grounds that it is, quote, not an effective approach to the, quote, swing voters in the middle of the electorate, end quote. Now, this is Frank speaking again. Trying to figure out exactly where Hillary Clinton actually stands on political issues can be crazy-making. As a presidential candidate, for example, she says she deplores the revolving war between government and Wall Street because it destroys our trust in government, quote-unquote, a noble sentiment. When she ran the State Department, however, the door spun on a well-lubricated axis. As a presidential candidate, she opposes Obama's Trans-Pacific Partnership Treaty, as do I, as Secretary of State. However, she helped negotiate it. As a presidential candidate in 2008, she claimed to oppose NAFTA, the first great triumph of the Bill Clinton administration that not only she had supported, but as U.S. Senator, she had voted for numerous Bush administration free trade treaties. So the same is true nearly everywhere you look. The great imprisonment mania of the 1990s, for example, as First Lady Hillary's appetite to incarcerate was unassuageable. Quote, quoting Hillary, quoting Clinton, we need more and tougher prison sentences for repeat offenders, she said in 1994, kicking off a bloodthirsty call for more three strikes laws. On another day, 7 years later, Senator Hillary Clinton could be found urging law students to dare to care about the 1.5 million who have a parent in jail, end quote. Now, even the well-being of poor women and children, Hillary's great signature issue in her youth, and I would add supposedly, had to hit the bricks when the time arrived in 1996 for welfare reform, a measure she not only supported, but for which she lobbied. As a presidential candidate in 2008, Hillary liked to identify herself with a working class middle America. As a lawyer in Arkansas in the 80s, however, she was a proud member of the board of directors of Walmart, the retailer that had acted on middle America like a neutron bomb. As a student leader in the 60s, she opposed the Vietnam War. As a senator in the Bush years, she voted for the Iraq War. As a presidential candidate, she has now returned to her roots and acknowledges that her vote was wrong. I would add, ha-ha. You know, I mean, in power, you're going to see war from Clinton, from the Clinton administration. On the increasingly fraught matter of the sharing economy, the battle of Silicon Valley and Uber versus the workers of the world, Hillary actually tried to have it both ways. In the same speech in July 2015, I don't have time to actually talk about that. So anyway, that's just a few quick things. And then over one more thing. Let's see. Why did I have this marked off? This might have just been where I stopped in the book here. Yeah, I'm going to have to stop there. And we'll get more into this next show. So I have a ton of other lesser evil stuff. Criticism of lesser evilism, criticisms of keeping the corporate duopoly in power by giving it your vote and your time and your energy and your vision. And it's an article which I'm going to have to start and then complete next show to talk about. It's called The Time, but I want you to read it, please, if you want to. The Time is Now to Defeat Both Trump and Clintonian Neoliberalism, posted by Mark Lewis Taylor on July 19th, 2016 at Counterpunch, and that's counterpunch.org. And it says, it starts off with a very provocative quote, quote, if Trump is the price we have to pay to defeat Clintonian neoliberalism, so be it. Mumia Abu Jamal. Then just a beginning of the article. With these words, the revolutionary journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal offers a bold challenge to those who circulate the fear of a Donald Trump presidency to drum up a mandate for voting for Clinton. But it's not just a Trump presidency that needs defeating. It's just as important to defeat the very Clintonian neoliberalism whose party Sanders now joins. Amid our current political crisis of a rising political right and a consolidating corporatist state, what I discuss here as Clintonian neoliberalism, we need those movements more than ever, He's talking about movements before and around the Sanders campaign. We need more. Abu Jamal told Chris Hedges in another prison visit, quote, "This is our hour of protest. We have to physically resist. We will reclaim our power when we say no, when we refuse to cooperate. We must, in everything we do, defy the architects of imperialism, neoliberalism, and mass incarceration." The author of the article, not Jamal, says, I think this is the author of the article speaking, yeah, "I'm inspired and applaud, especially Cornel West for taking his fight from the Sanders campaign into supporting Jill Stein." Quote, at this writing, Cornel West has declared Hillary Clinton a disaster and opts now to support the Green Party candidate Jill Stein. And why don't we just end really quickly on that point? So why Jill Stein? Is it because the Green Party is so great? Well, the Green Party has some things going for it. They have they're not socialist, which is not good. You can't really be green without being socialist. There's just no way you can clean up the environment without a planned, democratically planned economy on a world scale, which is the essence of socialism, bringing democracy into the economy, into economic decisions. Without that, forget about it. We're toast as far as environment goes, because you'll always have countries and corporations that will refuse to be as enlightened as, say, any country or corporation, any country, corporations, forget about it, that you manage to get temporary political power in under capitalism with a green type of government. And the Green Party, by the way, record in other countries is really sad. So the Green Party has a lot of problems, not explicitly anti-capitalist, although they just passed some internal platform stuff against capitalism. But what the Green Party has is a lot of left-wing independent politicians use the Green Party ballot lines to run, and the Green Party doesn't try to, like, you know, command them to be less left-wing or whatever. So there are some, like, ex-Black Panthers and so on who have, you know, been running as Green Party candidates with some success. Howie Hawkins, also not an ex-Black Panther, but a socialist, ran a Green Party ticket twice. You had others doing this because the Green Party has ballot access in a lot of places, most states, which is very good. And they don't take any corporate money, which is excellent. But if you listen carefully, what Socialist Alternative is proposing, what I'm proposing as well as part of Socialist Alternative, is to say, look, the Jill Stein campaign itself, that's worth supporting. That's interesting. Despite any reservations you may have about the Green Party, the Jill Stein campaign will attract some of the best activists that see through the duopoly structure, see through lesser evilism, and are willing to do something about it. And through the campaign, if, for example, Jill Stein polls 5% or more, this will add credibility and add actually resources to the fight for a third party, not meaning the Green Party and not meaning just any third party, but a party for the 99%, a party, progressive party for working people that will only come from, you know, failed electoral attempts, by the way, but will also come from movements and from various streams. And we think the left wing of the Green Party will be one of those streams that will go into a future party for working people, party for the 99%. And that is why the Jill Stein campaign deserves a lot of attention, deserves your vote, deserves our vote, and deserves meeting up with people that are already, or that are on their way, or just decided yesterday that they had it with the choices on offer from capitalism, Republican or Democratic Party candidates. So we're going to end with that. We really want to thank you for listening. We want to thank you for your support. Again, you can support us by going to the Socialist Alternative Radio Facebook page. And we really appreciate the number of people that we see out there that are going against the tide of you know, basically capitalist politics, basically the duopoly. Sometimes in politics, obviously, you have to stand against the stream. You know, and everything seems to be going the way of sort of the broadly speaking socialist left, and I mean very broadly speaking. Sanders was never a socialist, but the socialist term was, put on his campaign, and he was never a socialist, you know, in recent decades, and his campaign was not socialist, and he's not a socialist. But the word socialist was floating around his campaign. There's a lot of polling data, which we've discussed in the show before, where support for the word socialism, however defined that might be, is increasing, and I know from being active as a socialist that Socialist Alternative is growing, socialist groups are growing, socialism is not the Cold War boogeyman that it was for some, And also, if you read anything by Marx or Lenin or Trotsky or Luxembourg or Alexander Kollontai or anybody that wrote about socialism, so many people, Albert Einstein wrote about socialism favorably, you'll see that they make the point that, look, capitalism has set it up for socialism. It's both a threat, obviously, to socialism and a threat to the planet, a threat to people and hurting people and exploiting people and exploiting nature horribly. That's capitalism. But on the other hand, it set up the objective prerequisites for socialism, socialized production. Most people living in, you know, in social ways, dependent on each other. They're not out trying to live off the grid, everybody, which doesn't really work, by the way. And there's more people living in cities than any other time. And there's this huge infrastructure around the world that, if coordinated and planned democratically, which is really what socialism is, for human need and not for profit, that is what will save the planet for human habitation. It's what will create a decent living standard for everyone. And that's what will move society forward to things that we can't even imagine in terms of a better life for everybody on the planet and a better life for the ecology, for the environment. And, you know, that starts with small steps, including small steps like getting together the forces for in the most powerful capitalist country in the world, the forces for an independent political party, independent from big business and the corporations, and one that puts forward an anti-capitalist program, or at least somewhat, that puts forward a program for working people that points to the direction of socialism more clearly. And that's what we can gain, hopefully. Some of the elements of that are the Jill Stein campaign and many other places, many other movements and so on. So get in touch with Socialist Alternative at socialistalternative.org to find out more. And tune in also to Socialist Alternative Radio when we're on a week from today. I don't have the date in front of me. And again, you know, take our information and use it to become active in the struggle for socialism, and as your personal, you know, ammunition in the class struggle to fight for your rights as a working person, to fight for your rights as a young person in this society, to not only survive but to flourish. And it's impossible under capitalism, but we can use capitalism, use our political energy and what we're fighting for to lead to that eventuality under socialism. So thanks again, and listen to this song. This will help you along your way.
Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. Sky. Imagine all the people living for today. Imagine there's no countries. It isn't hard to do. Nothing to kill or die for, and no religion too. Imagine all the people living life in peace. You may say no.